Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of my favorite co-combatants in that war is our first guest. She joins us each week. A longtime syndicated columnist, these days blogging to a fairly well at dianawest.net, also periodically at the Daily Caller and elsewhere. She is the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She is, of course, Diana West. Welcome back, Diana. Good to have you.
Wonderful to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
Let me ask you about something that I suspect has troubled you, as it has me, and that is that in the course of the campaign, Donald Trump made much of the fact that it was imperative that we be able to name the enemy we confront if we are to defeat them. And he was very critical of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and many of the Republicans he was running against and others who have refused to do that over the past 16 years, leaving us, I would argue, in pretty much the fix we're in today, which is we're not winning. This week, we have, of course, commemorated the anniversary of multiple attacks against us. It wasn't just on September 11th, 2001. It was 2008. Also, of course, Benghazi 5 years ago. In each of four statements, the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the attorney general declined to use even the term that the president himself had embraced, radical Islamic terrorism. Diana West, what is going on?
This is a watershed moment, truly, in terms of the disappearance of 9/11 as a historical event during which pious Muslims attacked the United States of America as part of their jihad. If you can't say that, if you can't understand that, then you certainly can't defend yourself against any future attack. But we're at a point where we say never forget and never forget and never forget. And the president says never forget. And yet that is exactly the exercise, the political exercise that all of our elites have been undertaking since 9/11. And now it includes President Trump.
Yeah. You know, what disturbs me most about it, Diana, as I think you are very well aware, is it's not only misleading the American people about the nature of the problem and compounding, as I discussed a moment ago, the problem of doing something effective about it. But what we know, Diana, about the doctrine of the Sharia supremacists who actually are the enemy suggests that they're likely to take this behavior on our part in a way that will make our problems even greater.
I think that's exactly correct. I think that there is a terrible behavior in terms of presenting to the world, to the Islamic world, a craven face, a face that is so afraid to discuss Islam, that is so afraid to discuss Sharia, that is afraid for all these years going back. I mean, I was reviewing the many, many 9/11 columns I've written over the years for my syndicated column, and this also includes the failure to even draw pictures, to even publish pictures, cartoons of Muhammad. This used to be a great concern to us. We used to actually discuss this with the Kurt Westergaard Danish cartoon and so on. That is now down the memory hole. We have ramped up into a new cycle of jihad. It was much more theoretical 10 years ago. We could publish images of Muhammad in accordance with the Sharia, which was exactly the capitulation that we were watching. Now, with the massive years and years of mass Islamic migration, particularly into Europe, but also into this country, we are now seeing these outposts of Sharia becoming much more accommodated, becoming into the fabric, and further dictating, now that we are no longer even depicting these images, which we never did, we are now not criticizing even the most extreme expressions of this kind of jihad, indeed an attack.
And it is emboldening our enemies. We had a terrific hour-long conversation with Rahim Kassan yesterday about his new book, No Go Zones. And again, as a former Muslim, he completely agreed that it is certain to make the problem worse. Diana, you're going to be addressing what may be at work in part here, namely the functioning of what has come to be called the deep state, operating against the Trump administration in a very interesting panel sponsored by Judicial Watch a little later this week on the 15th. Tell us a little bit about that program and give us a titillating forecast as to what you're going to say there.
I'm very pleased to be involved in this. We're going to be discussing the deep state, which will be informative and interesting to me as well, to find out what people believe that we can, how we can define this and get a handle on it. Deep state has become kind of a caricature almost of something that we can all see, that I think we should be narrowing the definition down to understand it as subversion, as domestic subversion, and even introducing that old aspect of un-American activities. What we're looking at are efforts to subvert the Constitution, efforts to subvert the open functioning of our lawful political process. And that isn't just some sort of cartoonish deep state figure that could come off of an HBO show. This is a concerted effort by subversives, another word we're not allowed to use anymore, but we should be dusting off, in order to engage in these anti-constitutional and indeed, I would argue, un-American activities. So this should be a very interesting opportunity to sort of hash some of this out.
Indeed, and I hope it will, in fact, expose, not just sort of in the abstract what's going on, but name names and hold in particular accountable people who I think are very much involved, among other things, in what we just talked about, that dumbing down of the president's lexicon, namely his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, who came to office is for a staff meeting and announced that he disagreed with the use of the term radical Islamic terrorism, the president's chosen formulation. And lo and behold, several months into office, that's gone. It's down the memory hole, as you say. Diana, very quickly, there was an interesting development with the Supreme Court yesterday. They decided not to allow the Ninth Circuit once again to gum up the works with the president's immigration pause. I wonder what your thoughts are about specifically an issue that I'm very engaged on, as you know, with our amicus brief to the Supremes about this, namely the point of the exercise being to try to reduce the likelihood we're going to import more jihadists and adapting a filter along the lines of what we did in the past. You've written extensively on, you know, what we have done in this regard, particularly with hostile ideologies like Nazism and communism. Talk a little bit about, you know, the way ahead here, as you see it.
Well, the way ahead here, I'm afraid, seems very dark at this moment, because this is a very urgent issue that requires a president who believes it, believes in the importance of protecting the United States from further subversion by Islamic ideologies, as we discuss in terms of the spread, the democratic and demographic spread of Sharia, that really needs to be discussed with the American people. He gave a marvelous speech as a candidate, I believe it was in August of 2016, where he discussed, yes, and he discussed the threat posed by importing Sharia, which comes with Islamic immigration, pure and simple. This needs to be developed, expressed, laid out, not in Twitter. This needs to come as a fantastic speech by, you know, someone of the caliber of Stephen Miller, you know, or someone who's an Islamic expert. I don't know if that his expertise goes to these issues. And discussed with the American people so that they can understand how it is that it's our immigration policy that is our greatest tool, not only of national enhancement and getting, you know, the best people in the world to help our country grow, but to protect us, to protect our constitutional liberties from people who want to come here and set up a completely different kind of society in which our constitutional freedoms can no longer exist.
Indeed. Diana, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. We have so much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. But in the meantime, thank you for these insights into What I fear, if the president does not take corrective action like you've just described, will be a colossal bait and switch on the American people who voted for precisely that kind of agenda last November. We'll talk with you again soon, my dear. Next up, we will speak with Philip Haney, a man who has had considerable insights into this problem, both with the deep state and with the Sharia supremacists. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, I couldn't be more pleased to say, by Philip Haney, one of the men I've come to admire most for both his service to our country, many years in the Department of Homeland Security as one of the Customs and Border Security officers. He is also the author of, co-author, I should say, with Art Moore, of a terrific best-selling book, See Something, Say Nothing. A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. He is a man who has been active since he left government service, trying to arouse our country to the threats we're facing from Sharia supremacism. He's an extraordinary expert on these subjects and a good friend, and I'm delighted to have him back with us. Phil Haney, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be there.
You are joining us from Israel, I'm pleased to say. I wanted to ask you to talk, Phil, perhaps from the perspective of looking at America from overseas, at what's playing out at the moment here involving the next secretary of the department in which you served as original plank holder, as a matter of fact, from the founding of it. The Department of Homeland Security. Politico is reporting that the leading candidate to fill that job is one Michael McCaul, a representative from Texas in the U.S. House of Representatives, who currently serves as the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. Phil, you had some difficulties with the Department of Homeland Security, and at one point I know sought his help, and I wonder if you could quickly tell us a little bit about your difficulties and also the help that you sought. Secretary of Homeland Security. Phil, over to you.
We all remember the Boston Marathon bombing, which happened in April of 2013. Well, that Thursday, the bombing was on Sunday, the House Committee on Homeland Security held a hearing on the Boston Marathon bombing and had Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security, come and testify before the committee on the particular individual that had been taken into custody, taken to the hospital, and interviewed by the FBI. His name was Al Harbi. He was a Saudi student. Well, when Secretary Napolitano came in and testified before the committee, Vice Chairman Jeff Duncan asked her specifically, was there a Saudi individual involved in any way with Boston Marathon bombing? And she specifically said there was no person of interest, no subject of interest, and no one who was scheduled to be deported on, you know, from America. And it was all false because I had already submitted the information to the House committee that there was indeed a person from Saudi Arabia who was a subject of interest. So what happened was that information was leaked. Eventually, the Department of Justice got involved. They convened the grand jury, and they tried to find probable cause to indict me and put me in jail on criminal charges for leaking the information that came out of the House committee. And Mike McCaul, even though he knew that I was being investigated and had asked for the information to prove that Janet Napolitano was not telling the truth, allowed me to be investigated and didn't intervene.
In fact, as I understand it, he actually kind of sicked the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security on you as well. Is that right?
Well, the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security was involved. internal affairs of Customs and Border Protection was involved. The Department of Justice was also involved. And Mike McCall was the chairman of the committee. I had gone to him initially to ask him to help in talking about the fact that the government was deleting information from the system related to the Muslim Brotherhood and another large group called Tablighi Jamaat.
Would you just be able to characterize, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of causes for complaints about Michael McCall, but just to summarize, Phil Haney, was he demonstrating in this particular instance, based on your own firsthand experience, the kind of leadership, to say nothing of clarity, about the nature of the enemy we're facing and the degree to which, among other things, our government had been suborned, penetrated, or otherwise rendered less effective in dealing with Sharia supremacism in general, and specifically the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States?
He has been closely affiliated with CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, which we all know is a front group for the Muslim Brotherhood.
For Hamas, for God's sake.
Yes. I had a picture taken with Mustafa Carroll, who is president of CARE in Texas, and wrote that a moderate Muslim is our most effective weapon, right on the picture of he and Mustafa Carroll together.
Suggesting that CARE is moderate, of course.
Yes, CARE. It was proven in federal court. This actually goes back for 10 years. We're dealing with organizations that were proven irrefutably by the federal government 10 years ago to be linked to Hamas. Why on earth would the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security get within 100 yards of anybody that's closely affiliated with a known Hamas supporter?
Let alone essentially endorse them in this manner. This speaks to a question that you have written about extensively, you've spoken across the country about, it's featured in your book, See Something, Say Nothing, namely what's been described as willful blindness. Can we afford, as a practical matter, Phil Haney, based on your deep knowledge of these issues and your experience in the Department of Homeland Security, another secretary of that department, like Janet Napolitano, and others, for that matter, who have been willfully blind to this threat, this present danger of Sharia supremacism, not just elsewhere, not just of the violent kind, but here and of the stealthy civilization jihadist kind that the Muslim Brotherhood practices?
Well, none of us would take that level of risk with our own family or our own business if, for the sake of discussion, I'm only 20% right or 50% right in what I'm saying. Would that be an acceptable risk, that we can take the chance that, oh, Mr. Haney is only 20% right? No, of course not. We can't even afford to be 1% wrong. We have to be correct on this. And what Chairman McCall has demonstrated to me, when he told me face-to-face, and I mean literally face-to-face in his office, he would protect me and he would protect the information, and then turned around and did exactly the opposite, did not protect me and did not protect the information.
And that information, of course, was, as you say, Phil Haney, information about enemies operating in this country that you had developed in the course of your official duties and were being punished for having brought to bear, and this information was being destroyed by your agency. I mean, all of this is such a scandal. Where was Michael McCall?
He was right in the middle of it. He knew from the, literally, again, the face-to-face conversation I had with him with my computer in his office in just after the Boston Marathon bombings and before. I actually met with him several times. He knew exactly what the situation was with groups like CARE and Islamic Society of North America and North American Islamic Trust, the very ones that were named in the Holy Land Foundation trials, co-conspirators in the largest counterterrorism trial in American history. He knew.
So he knows about it, but he's doing nothing to correct it, either as the chairman of this oversight committee And God help us should he become the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Phil, we have to leave it at that, but I know there will be more of this conversation if this nomination actually emerges. I pray it will not, and if it does, that you will be one of the witnesses against the McCaul nomination in the United States Senate. Thank you for your service to our country, Phil, and for joining us from Israel today. It's great to talk with you as always. Keep up the good work, my friend. Congressman Chris Stort, member of the House Intelligence Committee, joins us right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I say we are joined by the representative of the people of the 2nd District of Utah. His name is Congressman Chris Stort. He is, among other things, in his roles in the Congress, a member of the House Appropriations Committee, and he also serves on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. I have to say, that doesn't begin to do justice to what an extraordinary man he is. He has served with great distinction in uniform as a command pilot of B-1 bombers. In fact, he set the world speed record, as I understand it, for around the world to travel in one of those aircraft, as well as having done with considerable distinction other feats of derring do in uniform, as well as an author of more books than I can count. I think 17 was the last, as I recall. And of course, as a successful businessman out in Utah. So for all these reasons, he is a Renaissance man and an always welcome guest at Secure Freedom Radio. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh, it's good to be with you.
So let me ask you about a couple of things that are on my mind and see what you think of them, sir. We have been talking in the course of the program today about the failure of the administration, having come to office, in part at least, on the promise to name the enemy. On the occasion of the 9/11 anniversary, successive members of the administration, starting with the president himself, chose not to do so. Should we take that as a sign that something is amiss, or that it's just kind of more of the business as usual that has, I believe, not proven very successful in defeating the enemy? Because you can't, of course, if you don't name it.
You know, Frank, I don't know the answer to that question. I just think it might be too early to draw an assumption. I can tell you that I agree, and as you and I have talked about many times on your radio, it's important to define with clarity who and what it is you're fighting and why you're fighting them. And you can't do that if you bring ambiguity into it as to what that exactly is. I don't think the president or the administration has done what the previous administration did, and that's to refuse to do that as part of their tactics, as part of their public relations, as part of their, you know, idea of tamping down emotion and Islamic phobia. I don't think this administration has done that, but I would encourage them not to do that. Again, it's important for us to be clear with the American people who and what it is we're fighting. And part of that is just being willing to say it.
Let me ask you, first of all, I personally think Sharia supremacism is what we're fighting, but I'd be interested in how you would define it. Also, I would ask you, when you hear the president, when you hear the vice president, when you hear the secretary of defense, when you hear the attorney general of the United States, all using euphemisms that are at best sort of a variation on terrorism, but some of them, for example, Jim Mattis said, these are maniacs in false religious garb. Now, Congressman Stort, you've spent time fighting these wars in the Middle East, among other places. I think you know these are not people who are in false religious garbs. They may or may not be maniacs. They're authentically practicing what the authorities of Islam teach. Would you walk us through your thinking on how we should describe these guys?
Well, I have no problem with calling them maniacs, and in some cases, I wouldn't have any problem calling those who have false religious garbs. In some cases, that may be true. But as you said, Frank, in its entirety, this isn't an aberration or a bastardization of some of their core beliefs. There are so many of them who, as you said, believe in Sharia supremacy, and that is their goal. And I just think we have to be willing to tell the American people that.
I do too. Congressman, it's one of the things we admire about you. Let me ask you about something on which I think we may disagree, and that is this deferred action on childhood arrivals, better known as DACA. Of course, President Trump has thrown the ball to you all to do something about this. There's now talk about some kind of legislation that would formalize it and approve basically what Barack Obama did, kind of an amnesty for these so-called children. At the same time, there will be no evidently effort made to prevent, by a physical barrier at least, more of them from coming seeking amnesty in the future. Where are you on this, sir?
Yeah, you know, after all the many conversations we've had, I think we really might have found the one thing that we may disagree on. We can have maybe a gentleman's agreement to disagree on this. But part of it is born out of my experience in the military, where I knew a few individuals there who were brought there truly as children. And I know you emphasized children in your comments about that. And the point being, well, some of them come as 17, 18, 19-year-olds and, you know, claim child status. But, I mean, these were individuals who came here in one case at a few months old. And they were serving in the military, and they were serving well. And again, I think that's kind of colored my opinion on this. The second thing is just the reality, and this is where you and I might disagree, but the reality of how disruptive, and I would even argue impossible, it would be to identify these individuals and to force them to leave the country for something that it really truly is no fault of their own. They have nowhere to go. You know, they don't have family, they don't have a relationship, they don't, in some cases, even know where they came from. So it seemed to me like this is a reasonable compromise. And one other thing that I think is really important to know, and if you go back and review the history, Barack Obama promised that he was going to deal with the problem we have with our immigration. And he didn't. He had a supermajority in the House and the Senate. They didn't deal with it. And my conclusion is, from that and other evidence, the Democratic Party doesn't want to solve this problem. They want the issue. They would much rather have the emotion and the argument and the money and the attention than they would actually solve this problem. And if that's the case, then it falls upon us to do what we think can help in this situation. And again, I just think that some of the legislation that I've sponsored specifically for those serving in the military is a reasonable compromise.
I want to come back to that, if I may, but just to work through the logic of this, Congressman. We're talking about an amnesty at a moment when there is not an ability to prevent more people from bringing more children here illegally and in turn, presumably, qualifying for amnesty as well, with all that that means for chain migration and vastly larger numbers of people becoming American citizens or, you know, at least getting green cards and status here. Does the prospect that, as part of the wheeling and dealing that's now going on in the Hill, that you may get some action on DACA but no action on the wall, as it's called, uses just the briefest of formulations, does that trouble you, Congressman?
Yeah, I think in this case you and I actually do agree, and I would support and I would argue for tying DACA to the completion of the wall, not only just the start but the actual completion. So that we can say, and I think it would incentivize both, by the way, for those of us who feel that these individuals who came here as children, we truly need to deal with them, but also feel like the primary and the first thing we need to do is to secure our southern border. Again, it may incentivize, you know, those two groups of political leaders to work together on this. But until we can go to the American people and say with a straight face, to look them in the eye and say, honestly, we have done what we promised we would do to secure our southern border. And frankly, not just our southern border as well, because many of these people enter the country legally under visas and overextend their visas. So it's not just that. But once we've done that, and now can we deal with DACA? I think that might be a situation where we would be able to assure them we've taken care of the threat, and now let's deal with those individuals who are here and came here as children.
I think that does make sense. Congressman, quickly and very quickly, just on the Enlist Act, which I think is one of the initiatives you're referring to based on your experience in the military, one of my concerns, and I would think it would be that of people in uniform as well, is while these may be perfectly decent individuals and so on, they are coming into uniform service having willfully or innocently, but nonetheless, violated the law. And is that something that we should be ignoring? And if we are going to ignore it, are we not going to find ourselves having to ignore a lot of other laws that should be considered disqualifying for military service if they're violated?
Yeah, you know, in a perfect world, we would say that only those who have never violated the law could enter the military, but we would have a very small military. I'm not sure you and I would be there, Frank, if we went back to our teenage days.
Well, speak for yourself, Congressman. I lived a good, clean life.
I understand your point, and it's not a meaningless point. There's no doubt. I'm just willing to concede that we'd be willing to accommodate that still.
Got it. Okay. Congressman Chris Stewart, thank you so much for your time today, as well as your extraordinary and ongoing service to our country. We appreciate it greatly and look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Come back to us soon, sir. Next up, we'll get an opposing view on DACA from the congressman's colleague, Paul Gosar, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by another member of the House of Representatives. He represents the people of the 4th District of Arizona. His name is Dr. Paul Gosar, a dentist by training, but now one of our country's, I think, most courageous and thoughtful legislators, with responsibilities, among other things, on the Committee on Oversight and Governmental Reform. He serves on its Subcommittee on National Security, Homeland Defense, and Foreign Operations. It's great to have him back. Dr. Gosar, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Well, I'm particularly glad you're with us because we just had a conversation with your colleague and my friend and yours, I'm sure, Chris Stewart, about DACA. And he takes the view that, well, we need to bring these young people into the legitimate light of day. What are your thoughts on what the president has done so far and what is seemingly in the offing now on the Hill?
Well, DACA is the dessert. And what I mean by that is I think that Chris Stewart thought about tying them being able to stay with completion of the wall. But it goes even further. It means that they have to be tied all the way across the board. I'll give you an example. If we allow DACA to go through as they're talking about without addressing chain migration, then what ends up happening is these kids that were brought in egregiously against their own actions bring in the lawbreakers through chain migration. This has got to stop. We ought to go back and see what it takes to be a rightful citizen in this country. Why does it take 10 years? Why does it take hundreds of thousands of dollars? And look at that rightly. We need to define birthright citizenship because, as Rand Paul articulately said during the debates, that's not been settled, particularly on illegal immigrants. It was settled on regards to somebody legally into this country, but never somebody illegally. We have to look at sovereignty of our country, the ability of a country to define its borders and to sovereignly say, listen, you're in, you're out, and making sure that the rule of law is upheld. So there's a lot to this story, and I hope that Americans really tie this. They can be compassionate, but we also want to make sure that we teach kind of the one of the sayings from Christ is, give a fish to a fisherman, you feed him for a day, but teach the fisherman how to fish. You teach them for a lifetime.
Amen to that. This sounds as though it's a prescription, Congressman Gosar, for comprehensive immigration reform. Is that what you're calling for? And if so, would it be something along the lines of what we saw offered up by the Gang of Eight and the Senate last time around?
I'm not a big fan of comprehensive anything, because what ends up happening, Frank, up on the Hill, when you say comprehensive, you're going to get a lot of crap thrown into there. Immigration is one of those issues that makes it so profound for us to break it down into smaller pieces and share that with the American people so that they know inherently what is behind it, who benefits, who's held accountable. And you start piece by piece by piece by piece. That restores trust. Trust is a series of promises kept. And that's why the American people don't trust government. They don't trust Congress because they throw these big packages together instead of articulately deciding and debating in front of the American people and listening to them. That is key and crucial to this whole aspect. So if you're going to talk about comprehensive, you've got to do it piece by piece by piece, not all in one piece.
But trust as the underpinning of it all is such an important insight, Congressman Gosar.
And you got to build it.
Yeah, you got to try to get it back, most especially. Let me ask you about a couple of things that speak to whether Congress and for that matter, the government more generally is trustworthy. The Supreme Court yesterday, happily, did block the latest outrage by the Ninth Circuit about this immigration pause executive order the president has offered as a means of trying to stop importing more jihadists. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this, Congressman. The purpose of this is somehow gone over the side completely. The purpose has been, of course, to try to accomplish what the president described as extreme vetting. I'm not sure that's the best term for it, but at least to try to filter out the people that you genuinely do not want coming to this country. I think of them as Sharia supremacists. But what are your thoughts on where this stands and whether we're likely to get not only the president's authorities upheld, as they should be, of course, but also a good outcome in terms of protecting our people?
Well, I applaud the Supreme Court, but I actually think it will go farther and uphold the president's right of due diligence in regards to this protection of the United States. I don't get what part of Sharia actually is applicable with our Constitution. I flat don't get it. Number two is I don't understand the Ninth Circuit. They've hemmed and hawed, and they've come up with every other ruling that really doesn't apply in this jurisdiction. That means that we've got a court system that's out of whack. And the late Anton Scalia used to teach us that we as Congress control the purse strings of all lower courts, not only from the money that they get, but also the issues they can take up. And we also have a checks and balances with them, and that is the impeachment of federal judges. You know, I'm from Arizona. We were actually held back from our entry into the United States because our first attempt was that we wanted to recall federal judges. We were so far ahead of our time. You know, so from that standpoint, I think this is a good thing, but we want to make sure that we get this put fully with the Supreme Court. Most people don't realize this is about governments that don't have a centralized government, so there's no ability for them to actually evaluate these people.
Or in some cases, they're just hostile governments. It's not just that they're failed states. Iran, for example. Well, let me turn to one other thing before we run out of time, Congressman. We have talked before about the assault on freedom of speech, much in evidence, of course, in the aftermath of the Charlottesville riots. The president is meeting with Congressman Tim Scott today. This is about, you know, his response to that episode. Featured prominently in much of this is a group called the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has been vilifying lots of folks, including yours truly, about the effort to speak truthfully, among other things, about this threat from Sharia supremacism. What are your thoughts on where we are with respect to freedom of speech and what we need to do to protect it?
Well, first of all, Frank, I didn't know that sticks and stones may break my bones, but names and words will never hurt me. You know, that's the old adage that, parents taught children is having a thick skin. But boy, this hateful speech, where the Southern Poverty Law Center is going is trying to tie our application of free speech to that of Europe, where you can recite factual evidence but then be contrarily deemed an insurgent by the government. And so this has to be one of those aspects where we as conservatives start to attack on the other side, because it is a formation, an assault on the very formation of this country.
It is indeed. First, foundational principles and freedoms. Congressman, finally, let me ask you, in connection with your role in the Subcommittee on National Security and Homeland Defense and Foreign Operations, several contractors have come forward in the wake of the latest anniversary of the Benghazi attack, also a 9/11 attack, lest we forget, that complained that they were, first of all, denied the opportunity to provide security there, then at the last minute asked to do it, unable to do it in time, unfortunately, then silenced by Hillary Clinton's State Department from saying anything about what happened. And now we're warning that if we continue giving low bidders the responsibility for providing security at these foreign missions, that we're likely to see more Benghazis in the future. Your thoughts on all of that, sir?
Well, you know, it's not just Hillary Clinton, it's Barack Obama. So we have to lay the accountability where it's so deemed. But no, we have to have that conversation in regards to, you know, what comprises a bid. I want to make sure that there's fair and open bidding, but we have to take all things in open settings. What have you accomplished? How have you provided security in the past? There's got to be some due diligence to historical application of way a bidder actually does their job and is accountable for that job.
No sweetheart deals or just low bidders without capability. Congressman Paul Gosar, we are hard out of time, sir. I appreciate so much yours today, as well as all that you do for our country in the United States Congress, representing with such distinction the people of the 4th District of Arizona. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.